Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 279 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 1 exam. This is going to be series 12. And for this, I'm going to be just, for the most part, talking about prostaglandins. Prostaglandins are, unfortunately, kind of a high-yield thing to know for the USMLE Step 1 exam. There are many of them. There's like a ton. But I just want to go over the classic ways they are tested, go over the pathway, make sure it's something that you really understand. So this should be a short and sweet podcast. So let's jump right into it. Well, I guess maybe I shouldn't call this a rapid review series. I'll just call this the prostaglandin podcast for step one or the USMLEs or whatever. Okay, so let's just jump right into it, right? So what if they give you, so maybe let's talk about the pathway. I think maybe that may be the smart thing to do first, right? So we know that prostaglandins, they don't just drop from the sky, right? They don't just come from thin air. So what's the deal with these prostaglandins? Well, we know that membrane phospholipids, you ultimately need to convert them to arachidonic acid, right? So this is done by an enzyme known as phospholipase A2, right? And that phospholipase A2 then is inhibited by corticosteroids. So that's ultimately how steroids work as immunosuppressants, right? They crush phospholipase A2, so you're not able to convert those membrane phospholipids to arachidonic acid. And then as a side note here, I think I would want you to remember that phospholipase A2 has a receptor that it acts on, okay? And when you develop antibodies against that receptor, that's actually associated with people having membranous nephropathy. That's one of those weird associations that are floridly high yield to know for step one, for sure, right? When a person has autoantibodies against the phospholipase A2 receptor, that's associated with membranous nephropathy. In fact, that's something that they routinely test on the USMLE exams, especially step one and also step two CK as well. So again, membrane phospholipids, phospholipase A2 helps you make arachidonic acid. And in that arachidonic acid can go down the leukotriene pathway under the action of lipoxygenase, right? So lipoxygenase helps you convert the arachidonic acid to leukotrienes. And then if you're looking on the other end of the spectrum, cyclooxygenase can help you convert the arachidonic acid to prostaglandins, right? And obviously we know that cyclooxygenase can be inhibited, right? So it can be inhibited by NSAIDs. Although remember that aspirin is an irreversible inhibitor of the cyclooxygenase enzyme. And then other NSAIDs are reversible inhibitors of the cyclooxygenase enzyme. And then if we're looking at things from the leukotriene perspective, there is also a drug that inhibits lipoxygenase, right? In this case, lipoxygenase will be inhibited by Xyluton. Xyluton is a leukotriene antagonist, right, that works specifically by inhibiting lipoxygenase. So just something to commit to memory there. Now, the next thing I would say is that leukotrienes, right? Remember, leukotrienes, they are very important on NBM exams. Probably like the biggest one is leukotriene B4. Remember, it's a big-time chemotactic factor for neutrophils, right? It's a chemotactic factor for neutrophils. So if, for example, a person has like a leukotriene deficiency, right? Or they have like lipoxygenase dysfunction, the thing that's going to happen is they're not going to be able to attract neutrophils to the site of acute inflammation. Right, so leukotrienes, right, when they're produced, they can act on receptors. The big receptor I want to know for your exam is the CYSLT1 receptor, right? That's just another fancy name for the leukotriene receptor. That receptor is blocked by those leukast drugs, right? So drugs like montelukast or zafirlukast. So key to know about those things, right? And then again, we've talked about the cyclooxygenase pathway. And then one thing I want to talk about before I jump into the prostaglandins is talking about aspirin-induced asthma, right? So aspirin-induced asthma. So remember, these days it's now known as aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. The thing with aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease is that when you give a person aspirin, it would make sense that you should have less flux through the cyclooxygenase pathway and more flux through the lipoxygenase pathway. If you have more flux through the lipoxygenase pathway, the thing that's going to happen is you're going to produce a ton of leukotrienes, and leukotrienes, they are very powerful bronchoconstrictors, right? So they can potentially exacerbate a person's respiratory disease, especially if a person has a hyper-responsive airway, like a person that has asthma. And then again, before I jump to the prostaglandins, I promise I'm going to jump to them. But it's also helpful on NBM exams to know the function of thromboxane E2, right? Remember, thromboxane E2 really causes thrombosis, right? It really causes thrombosis. In fact, this is one of the reasons why, actually, this is the primary mechanism behind aspirin being an antiplatelet agent, right? By inhibiting cyclooxygenase, you're not going to make thromboxane E2. And if you don't make thromboxane E2, then the person will be fine, right? They're basically not going to promote that aggregation step of primary hemostasis. So they're ultimately going to be good, right? And again, I've talked about leukotriene B4, right? Has a specialized function as being a chemotactic factor for neutrophils. Another classic one you may also see is leukotriene D4. Occasionally, that pops up on NBM exams, right? Leukotriene D4, what does it do? Basically, it does a lot of bronchoconstriction, right? So again, it's not the nicest thing for a person that may have reactive airway disease. Basically, just think of it as the constricting leukotriene, right? It causes bronchoconstriction, it causes vasoconstriction, right? And then it can also increase vascular permeability. Because you may wonder, like, Divine, why is it that many of these people with autoimmune diseases tend to have hypertension? It's pretty easy. If a person has an autoimmune disease, they have a lot of inflammation going on all the time in their bodies. Well, many of these inflammatory agents are very powerful vasoconstrictors, right? And if you do that, that's going to raise your systemic vascular resistance. It's going to put the patient in some trouble, and they're going to have hypertension, right? So now let's go to the prostaglandins, right? So what if they give you a question about a lady, and they tell you that her membranes have ruptured, like, I don't know, like 24 hours ago, right? But she has not started having contractions yet, right? Again, that person has premature rupture of membranes. Because in general, right, when you rupture your membranes, you should be having contractions at the same time, right? So you can try to induce those contractions with a bunch of drugs, right? You can obviously use like oxytocin, for example. That's probably the most common agent that is used. But one agent you can use for sure is a prostaglandin E2 analog, right? A prostaglandin E2 analog, like dinoprostone, right? You can use dinoprostone. Although dinoprostone's job for the most part is to help you like ripen the cervix, but in some areas it can sort of help you induce labor. So that's a PGE2 analog, right? And one other thing that's high yield to know about dinoprostone is that you can actually use it technically to keep the ductus arteriosus open. The thing is, there's a lot of cross-functioning between these prostaglandins, because typically on NBM exams, the first line thing you should go with in terms of keeping the ductus arteriosus open is actually the prostaglandin E1 analog, alprostadil. And an easy way to remember that is PGE1 for first line, right? So alprostadil is a prostaglandin E1 analog. That's something you use to keep the ductus arteriosus open on NBM exams, right? So going back to the prostaglandin E2 analog, again, dinoprostone. Again, you can keep the ductus open. You can use it to induce labor. And it's also one of those things that induces fever and pain, right? Induces the sensation of fever, induces fever, and also induces the sensation of pain, right? Again, that's why when you're under an inflammatory state, like you have an infection or something, you know, you can have myalgias and all that bad stuff going on, right? And then alprostadil, again, I said it's a PGE1 analog, is something that is classically used to keep the ductus open on NBM exams, right? So what are those classic situations they give you on NBM exams where you'd have to keep the ductus arteriosus open? The classic presentation will be a newborn. Newborn was fine at birth, right? And then within a few hours to days of the newborn being born, the newborn has starts crashing and burning, right? They tell you that this newborn becomes super hypoxic, and then you're trying to give this newborn supplemental oxygen, but his O2 sats are not rising, or if they are, barely. Whenever you see stuff like that, right, you want to think about the child having some kind of cyanotic congenital heart defect that is being unmasked by the closure of the ductus, right? Because, say, for example, if a child has transposition of the great vessels, walk with me here for a second. In transposition of the great vessels, the right atrium drains into the right ventricle. That's normal. But then the right ventricle drains into the aorta. That is not normal, right? So the right ventricle is draining into the aorta, and the aorta sends blood around the body and brings it back to the right atrium, and then back to right ventricle, and then into the aorta. So you see that you're essentially recirculating deoxygenated blood. On the flip side, the left atrium is draining into the left ventricle. Left ventricle is draining into the pulmonary artery. The pulmonary artery sends blood to the lungs, gets it oxygenated, gets into the pulmonary vein, and then back to the left atrium. And then left atrium, left ventricle, pulmonary capillary again. So you have like two separate systems. One system is recirculating oxygenated blood. That's the left side of the heart. The other system is circulating deoxygenated blood. That's the right side of the heart. So the thing is, if you have two completely separate systems, the child will not get born in the first place. The child will die, right? Because you can't live circulating deoxygenated blood, right? So the thing that ultimately happens is if a person has a ductus, like a ductus arteriosus, which is something that many, you know, you have in utero, that ductus arteriosus allows mixing between the blood in the urine and the pulmonary arteries, right? So, you know, the child is still in some relative form of hypoxia, but it's better than it could be with two completely separate systems. But, so it's almost like that cyanotic congenital heart defect the child has is masked by the presence of a conduit, like the ductus arteriosus, that is letting blood between the left and the right sides of the heart mix. But once that child is born, well, what does the doctors usually do? The doctors closes. So once the doctor starts closing, it's almost like you're going to those two separate systems. The child is not going to survive that, and then the child can pass away pretty much, right? So your first step in management, whenever you see those things, they'll try to trick you on the exam into intubating. Don't do that. You're pretty much wasting your time. That hyperoxia actually can worsen the speed of the child's demise, right? So because when you have hyperoxia, right, or when you have like just a ton of oxygen around actually causes like a reflex vasoconstriction in most blood vessels. Remember, the lungs are kind of different when there's hypoxia, actually let me take a step back. So in the lungs, right, where there is hypoxia, the pulmonary vessels constrict so that you can redirect blood to other parts of the lungs that have adequate oxygenation, right? But in the body, if you think about it, right, when there is hypoxia in a part of the body tries to dilate the vessels leading to those areas so that you can send more blood there. But when there is a ton of oxygen around, then the body's like, you know, we got it from here. We have enough oxygen. So it's going to constrict. That constriction can be mediated by things like norepinephrine, right? So when you're giving that child supplemental oxygen or trying to intubate that child and give high flow, like a ton of oxygen straight into the airway, you're not really helping that child because that's causing like vasoconstriction. And because remember, the ductus arteriosus is literally a blood vessel, right? So you're literally closing up that blood vessel some more. So you're worsening, you're basically speeding up the child's demise. So in those circumstances, the best thing to do, right, is to give a prostaglandin E1 analog, like alprostadil, right? So I think the big thing to point out here is, and maybe like as a pro tip for the future, maybe consider this to be like your life lesson from this. Whenever you're making decisions, try to understand the why. Don't just do things because you want to do things, right? Many people fall into trouble in life because they feel that as long as I'm active doing something, it's the right thing to do. Now, the fact that you're doing something does not necessarily mean you're doing something profitable. Does not necessarily mean you're doing something that has much of an impact, right? So don't keep running this rat race in life where like you're doing all these activities. Like you see people, especially med students, you see them, they're like they're popping a ton of coffee, studying from 8 a.m. to like 9 p.m. every day, but you don't have good grades to show for it. Do some, again, I'm not trying to judge you, but just do some kind of self-examination. What am I doing wrong with my life? What am I doing wrong with my study process, right? Because if you're putting in that much time, you should be getting better results, right? So maybe just do some self, like I think one thing that's very important is just doing some self-examination, right? Do some self-examination. That will show you like, okay, maybe I should change my ways, change some things I'm doing so that I can do better, right? But let me get off that tangent, right? So again, when a person is hypoxic, giving oxygen is not always the right thing to do, I guess is what I'm trying to say here. But again, as I say in this podcast is not meant for clinical decision making. It's meant for test-taking purposes only, right? So when you see that child's case, right, give the child alprostadil. That's a PGE1 analog, right? And that's going to keep the ductus arteriosus open until you can then proceed to surgery. Now, another classic PGE1 analog you may see on exams is misoprostol, right? Misoprostol, remember, you can use it to induce labor, right? But another thing that they love to test on MBMEs with misoprostol is how if a person has peptic ulcer disease from taking NSAIDs, but they really don't need to take those NSAIDs because they have like some really bad inflammatory thing, joint problem, blah, 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 blah. You can give those people misoprostol. Misoprostol will essentially protect the lining of the stomach, right? So how does it do that? Well, remember, misoprostol, being a prostaglandin analog, actually cuts down on the secretion of gastric acid. So it's almost like it has this mucosal protective effect, right? So whenever a person has to take an NSAID, but they're having like gastric complications of taking that NSAID, like a gastric ulcer, you can basically give them misoprostol prophylactically at the same time so that they don't get those problems. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient that has like scleroderma or something like that, and the person, let's say the person has like, you know, has like the Raynaud's phenomenon and all that stuff, and for the last 6 months the person has been having like shortness of breath, exercise intolerance, has a loud P2 heart sound. Obviously that person has pulmonary vascular hypertension, right? So when a person has pulmonary hypertension, you want to try to give them something that can dilate their pulmonary vessels. So one thing you can do is you can give a prostaglandin F2 alpha analog, right? Like carboprost. Again, carboprost is a prostaglandin analog. It can dilate the pulmonary vessels and it can help. Although remember, carboprost though, in NBM exams, the first line thing I want you to think about with carboprost is that for the most part, it induces labor. Okay, it induces labor. It induces labor. And you can even use it to treat postpartum hemorrhage. Actually, you know what? Please scrub out. Let me just say this. For purposes of the NBM exams, scrub out pulmonary hypertension. I'll talk about the pulmonary hypertension prostaglandin in a bit. Scrub out carboprost as treatment for pulmonary hypertension. Think of it primarily as inducing labor and treating postpartum hemorrhage, right? So why does it treat postpartum hemorrhage? Well, the thing is, many uterine blood vessels are embedded within the myometrium. So the thing that happens is, if you can cause myometrial contraction, that's going to squeeze down on those blood vessels and cut off blood supply, right? So the woman stops bleeding. So carboprost, right, is classically used to treat postpartum hemorrhage. But remember, if a person has a history of like asthma, or again, really bad COPD, or really bad reactive airway disease, giving them carboprost for postpartum hemorrhage is not necessarily the smartest thing in the world to do. Because as you would see, carboprost is a very powerful bronchoconstrictor, right? So if you give it to those people, right, you can cause them to go into respiratory failure and die, right? Which you don't want. So again, carboprost, and again, I'll summarize all these things at the end, but carboprost, think of it as treatment for postpartum hemorrhage. Think of it as treatment for, to, you know, induce labor. And then the next one I want to talk about is, again, primary pulmonary hypertension. If a person has pulmonary hypertension, you can give them a PGI2 analog, right? So I almost think of PGI2 as the opposite of TXA2, right? So thromboxane E2 encourages platelet aggregation, right? But PGI2, think of it as platelet gathering inhibitor, right? So it basically prevents the aggregation step of primary hemostasis, but it's also a very good vasodilator, right? So these are drugs like iloprost or epoprostenol. These are wonderful drugs for treating pulmonary hypertension. And again, like I said, these also inhibit the platelet aggregation. So those are all big things you want to know. So let's summarize these prostaglandins, right? So let's start from PGE1. Remember, we have PGE1, alprostadil. Use that to keep the doctor's arteriosus open. Remember, we have another PGE1, that's misoprostol. We can use that to induce labor / ripen the cervix. We can also use that to prevent NSAIDs from essentially burning your stomach. And then remember, we have PGE2, like dinoprostone. We use that to induce labor. We can use that to keep the doctor's arteriosus open. But remember, that's like a second line thing. The first line thing for keeping the doctor's open is PGE1. That's our prostadil. And then remember that PGE2 also, again, mediates that sensation of fever and pain. And then remember the PGF2 alpha analog, carboprost. You can use it to induce labor, right? Because again, it causes myometrial contractions, but you can also use it to treat postpartum hemorrhage. Remember, if a person has reactive airway disease, that's not a good thing to do because it can cause bronchoconstriction. And then PGI2, remember, platelet gathering inhibitor. Those are drugs like epoprostenol and iloprost that you can use to treat primary pulmonary hypertension. And then don't forget other agents we talked about today. We talked about thromboxane E2 that promotes platelet aggregation, right? That's why we use aspirin. Aspirin inhibits COX. That'll kill TXA2 synthesis, right? So that you don't have thrombosis, right? That's why aspirin is an antiplatelet agent. And then we talked about leukotriene B4 being a chemotactic factor for neutrophils. We talked about leukotriene D4 being the constricting leukotriene. So it causes bronchoconstriction, causes vasoconstriction, and it also increases vascular permeability. So again, if you understand these things, I think you should, for the most part, be in good shape. So thank you for listening. Again, please subscribe to the podcast. It's on Apple Podcasts, it's on Google Podcasts, it's on Spotify. I also have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. So please subscribe to that. And then I also have a WordPress website, right? DivineInterventionPodcast.com. If you subscribe to that, then whenever I make a new podcast, you'll get an alert. And then I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, Step 1, Step 2, CK, Step 3. preclinical medical exams, third-year shelf exams. And also, if you're a medicine resident, and you need tutoring for the EBIM board exam, so the medicine in training exam, I'd be happy to tutor you for that. And one other thing I want to mention is, I've worked with tons of students that have been extremely successful. So again, if you need tutoring for those subjects, let me know. And also, you know, if you're going through the AMCAS process for getting to med school, or the ERAS process for getting to residency, like mock interviews, reviewing your application and stuff like that. Again, I've done that with tons of students. There are many people I've worked with that are now residents in many specialties all over the country. Like, I've worked with people that are derm residents. And again, I've worked with people that have a lot of tricky applications, like, oh, I failed the USMLE exam in the past. I don't have research. I have like these red flags on my application, blah, blah, blah. I've done all those things with people. And many of them, again, are matched residents. I mean, I've had people with failures on the exam that, again, right now, like, have interviews, right? So just something to keep in mind if you need specialized help in those areas. And then again, like I said, I have a comprehensive Step 2 CK course coming up from the 7th to 9th of January. Again, it's going to cover psych, neuro, peds, IM, surgery, OB-GYN, ethics, biostats, the new changes on the USMLE exams from like November of this year, like basically last month. And then I'm also, again, expanding the curriculum, right? Because previously I had a 10-hour course, but I'm going to phase that out. That's why it's now a 16.5-hour course. So again, it's from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, from the 7th to 9th of January. So again, there are still some spaces. So if you want to sign up, feel free to just shoot me an email through the contact button on the website. And then there's an NDME test taking strategies course on the 6th of January, again, 2021, right? From 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. We'll go through like standardized approaches to basically dealing with NBME questions. Again, many people have taken these courses and the vast majority of them have found it to be really helpful. And then again, just my quick life lesson here at the end here is, again, self-examination. I think that's the importance of self-examination. I kind of alluded to it during the early part of the podcast, but again, remember this, no one is perfect. Even I, Divine, I am not perfect. Again, I know many of you listening to this podcast may think that Divine is some superhuman, whatever. No, but no, I'm just a pretty ordinary guy like all of you. The key thing is just from time to time, you need to do some self-introspection. You need to do some self-examination, right? Because the thing is, life is really not worth living if you're not making any improvements, right? And you can make improvements, right? So you can make improvements in the way you study. You can make improvements in the way you live your life, in the way you show love to other people, in the way you do things, right? So just always do some self-examination, because the thing is, whether you like it or not, at some point, you will go through some examination in life. It's better for you to examine yourself and make corrections early than to wait till it's too late and then someone else examines you. And then when they examine you, they are not as nice to you. They are brutal to you, and you kind of foreclose your future that way, right? So like for a med student, if you notice that in your preclinical courses, you're getting pretty low scores, you're like borderline passing, do some kind of self-examination, speak to a tutor, speak to a mentor or something, so that people can, basically you want to make sure you analyze where things are going wrong so you can make improvements, right? You don't want to keep saying it will get better, it will get better, it will get better, and then you wait for the NBME, the USMLEs, to be the ones that evaluate you. And then you know, God forbid, fail a step one exam or something, and then begin to put like, just create a much, again, I'm not saying you can match with that, but you reduce the number of options you have and give yourself a much tougher road ahead when that's the case, right? So examine yourself so that others don't examine you, because others may not be as merciful when you're doing that self-examination. And when you do a self-examination, be very thorough with it. You know, take some time off, quiet place, sit down, seek out advice from mentors and stuff, and then come up with a specific action plan. Self-examination doesn't do squat if you don't have any specific action plan, right? So come up with a specific action plan, put it into practice, and then you begin to notice that things begin to go well for you. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.